Again, we come to a seasonal celebration. The wheel of the earth has turned. This time, a celebration of an earth season, a natural season, not a cultural or a religious one like Christmas or Hanukkah. As the Unsighted Meditation on Solstice from the Vancouver Sun says, we see it around us in the weather. The snow on the mountains, ski reports on the Weather Channel, reports of the road conditions on the Coquihalla Highway. We are forced to acknowledge the earth when the weather overwhelms our coping mechanisms of road clearing equipment to move the snow and salt to melt the ice. Then we must stop to notice the season. Hopefully we will see the beauty as well as notice the difficulties in getting around and the chilled toes we get when waiting for the bus or paddling on the Fraser River. When daylight savings time changes to standard time, again, we notice, like the girls in the story, that the days have shortened. The days are grayer even when the rain isn't settling in. But it does rain, and so it's darker yet. It is solstice, the time of the shortest day, the longest night. It is the darkest time of year, and so we do our best to light it up, whether by prosaic porch lights and street lights or decorative multicolored Santas and reindeer and trim around the house. We know that winter solstice only lasts for an instant, but we do mark the whole day, and of course it is tomorrow. The ancients made a big deal of such times. In ancient Rome, the festival of Brumalia, honoring Bacchus, god of agriculture and theater, lasted for a month, ending on December 25th, which was solstice night in their calendar. The festival included much drinking and merriment, which is why some people say that the Christians didn't like that. So they replaced it with their own December 25th festival. While I try to remember my connection to the wild, to the earth, all the time, it is at such times as the beginning of winter that I am forced to reflect again on how much we humans owe to the earth and how poorly we, even I, treat it. In 1940, soil conservationist Walter Loudermilk surveyed agricultural use, land use, and conservation across Africa, the Middle East, Europe, North America, and China. He saw the devastation that our generally poor conservation practices had wrought. He gives example after example of farming practices and land use that spoiled the earth, usually causing erosion to the point that it was no longer fruitfully farmed. Africa, the cradle of humanity, and Mesopotamia, the Fertile Crescent, are no longer the breadbaskets they used to be. It's hard to imagine those areas we know as deserts being fertile and fruitful. Historian of technology Lynn White Jr. wrote in 1967 about our relationship to the earth and how our religious beliefs affect it. Judaism and Christianity, the dominant religions of the West, emphasize the dominion humanity has over nature. Indeed, we are told that Adam named the animals, establishing dominance thereby. All of nature was for our benefit and our rule. People are not part of nature. They are made in God's image. Feminist critiques, such as provided by Carolyn Merchant, connected the gender of nature, female, with domination as well. Male privilege included ownership as well as supremacy. Whether or not you agree with these particular deconstructions of why the earth is in trouble, it is. This past 2 weeks, world leaders have been meeting in Copenhagen, trying to agree on how to mitigate climate change and global warming. Most of current science agrees that human activity has caused our climate to warm sufficiently that within mere decades, catastrophic problems will devastate Earth. I keep wondering how it would work if we considered the Earth itself holy and sacred, source instead of resource. Would we? Could we live on the earth while respecting its ecological integrity? Would we be close enough to the land to understand, to know its real needs and know how to best use it? Would we be able to get past self-interest in the short term to leave something for our grandchildren's future and for our great-grandchildren. It is sometimes said that Aboriginals of many areas of the world consider themselves part of nature and that they lived, when they lived their traditional lifestyle, in step with their land. Yet we know that some First Nations peoples did manage the land they lived on, often in ways not recognized by the European colonists who came in. Certainly, Indians of North America set fires and otherwise changed and managed their territory. They had many sacred places, many more than the North Americans of European descent, probably because they've lived here so much longer. Vina DeLaurier Jr., a Lakota Sioux activist, lawyer, and historian, sums up his view of the place of land in Native culture this way. Sacred places are the foundation of other beliefs and practices because they represent the presence of the sacred in our lives. They properly inform us that we are not larger than nature and that we have responsibilities to the rest of the natural world that transcend our own personal desires and wishes. This lesson must be learned by each generation. Unfortunately, the technology of industrial society always leads us in the other direction. Our industrial society's technology can have sweeping effects on the land. Consider modern industrial agriculture, whether growing monoculture crops or packed like sardines feedlots, or the chemical industry, especially before government regulations checked the worst of the offenses to waterways. But we still do not know if all the chemicals in our lives that pervade everything we have are part of the reason for the increase in the cancer rate. Our technology is really quite efficient at changing the earth. What would the earth be like? Would it be healthy if we deemed it holy? I'm actually not encouraged by the state of the holy river, the Ganges, in India. For Hindus, the Ganga is not just a river, but a mother, a goddess, a tradition, a culture, and much more. Some Hindus believe life is incomplete without bathing in the Ganges at least once. Many Hindu families keep a vial of water from it in their house. This is done because it is prestigious to have water of the Ganges there. And also so if someone is dying, that person would be able to drink its water. They believe that the water from the Ganga can cleanse a person's soul of all past sins and that it can also cure the ill. The Ganges is one of the dirtiest rivers in the world. Some of its natural water source is diverted for irrigation, and both sewage and industrial waste clog the rest of it. Global warming is now causing its source glaciers to retreat. I'm not sure if this is a good model. Being holy has not helped the Ganges River. Maybe it is just human nature to do all that we want to do without looking at the consequences. We humans are now so many, and our technology is so good, we must take more responsibility than ever for what we do. This is not news, I don't imagine, to most of us. I find it a bit dispiriting, though. The size of the problem is daunting to me. What can I, or we, do? World leaders can't even agree on how to do anything. Too many of us are just not willing to share the resources or give up our privileged lifestyle. We are indeed comfortable. It is dark. The night is long. The ancients asked at this time of year, and the children in our story, will the sun rise tomorrow? I ask, can our world return to a wholeness? What gives us hope at such a time? One of the assumptions at the Copenhagen Summit is that we must share the resources that we have, and we must limit our consumption of the Earth's resources. But many of the people, the nations there represented, were not able or to think about doing that. They're not willing. Writing in The Guardian, George Monbiot says that humanity is no longer split between conservatives and liberals, reactionaries and progressives, though both sides are informed by the older policies. Today, he says, the battle lines are drawn between expanders and restrainers, those who believe that there should be no impediments, and those who believe we must live within limits. The vicious battles we have seen so far between Greens and climate change deniers, road safety campaigners and speed freaks, real grassroots groups and corporate-sponsored astroturfers are just the beginning. This war will become much uglier as people kick against the limits that decency demands. I know many of us already try to live in a more restrained way. It's the only way I know to address the hopelessness of this situation. Even if the federal government won't act, we as individuals can do something. A few years ago, there was a government program called the One Ton Challenge. Remember Rick Mercer talking about it on TV? It urged Canadians to do things like take public transit more often, idle vehicles less, use programmable thermostats, seal windows with caulking and weather stripping, compost your kitchen waste, support green energy, conserve water and energy, purchase electronics labeled with Energy Star logo, recycle, use compact fluorescent light bulbs. It sounds a lot of pretty prosaic, doesn't it? Like we've done this already. It's all old hat. What's next? What can be next? It all feels inadequate somehow. Jim Merkel, author of the book Radical Simplicity, Small Footprints on a Finite World, suggests that there are three things that we should be doing to prepare for the changes ahead. 1, learn to feed ourselves. 2, decrease reliance on the automobile and the airplane. 3, build community. This is what we can do right now, he says. 1, learn to feed ourselves. How many of us have a place or could find a place to grow even some of our own food? I grow lettuce, sort of. Who else grows something? Strawberries? Gooseberries. Tom, what do you grow? Fruit. Tree fruit, yes. Some herbs, good. I grow mostly flowers. They're pretty. I do try to buy my food as locally as I can and what I can afford. Maybe I can dig up some more grass and plant some tomatoes. 2, decrease reliance on the automobile and the airplane. While we've already referred to transit and other public transportation, here in the suburbs, maybe giving each other rides, ride sharing is another way. And maybe occasionally use the transit. I guess we could do the staycation thing instead of flying off to the sunshine for the winter. This one seems harder for those of us who do have the cash for cars and holidays to think about. There's less to give up if you don't have the cash, if you don't have it already. 3, build community. One of the things that any church is all about is building community. Our culture is very individually oriented, though, and so he says it might be difficult to take it the steps further than what we already do. Do we insist that my understanding of what is right for the community is the way it must go? How do I get along if the majority think differently than I do? Giving up our vehicles will be difficult. Building a more communitarian style of living together may be even harder. But taking these kind of steps is what gives me hope in this dark time of the year, at this maybe dark time of human history. These are some concrete steps for sustainability of my food supply, some, even if small, limitations of the travel I do, and a greater emphasis on the relationships I build around me. While it may seem like deprivation at first, I wonder if we won't be happier in the long run. I want to close with a quotation from Peter Morales, the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association. He says, "I encourage you to be with your most precious memories of the holidays. Experience the love and joy once again. Our most precious memories have much to teach us. Our most cherished experiences are much more than nostalgia. They are religious teachers. Remembering is a spiritual practice. The lessons that our fondest holiday memories are trying to teach us can transform our daily lives, revitalize our congregations, remake our economy, change our politics, and bring lasting peace to the world. Love endures. Relationships really matter. In the long run, stuff doesn't matter. The implications are revolutionary. If we lived our lives with this in mind, we would nurture relationships with people we love. We would create religious communities that foster intimacy, and we would truly open our hearts to the newcomer. If we lived with the deep conviction that what connects us is sacred, exploitation would end. Violence would end. Peace would reign at last. Amen, and blessed be."